No one goes into war thinking that life on the battlefield will be easy. Over the years, the U.S. military has worked to improve conditions for troops burdened by the strains of combat. Last spring, along with the latest weapons, the military unrolled a new psychiatric component in the invasion of Iraq. A year later, the data on troop mental health is not so rosy. According to the Pentagon, 24 soldiers committed suicide since the war started last March. That works out to a rate of 17.3 per 100,000 soldiers. It's important to put that number in perspective. That's lower than the national average for men aged 20 to 34, but it's also much higher than the rate for troops in the first Gulf War, and even higher than it was during the Vietnam War. Add to that the results of a three-month survey by the Pentagon that shows troops worn out by the shifting demands of their mission and generally low on morale. Today, a look at the mental health and morale of service members in Iraq, where the new military's new programs have helped and what still needs to be done. We'll also talk about a poll recently released on reenlistment. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd be especially interested to hear from those of you who have served in Iraq. Call and tell us about the toll it took psychologically and what support systems were there to help. Are there suggestions you have for improvement? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Colonel Virgil Patterson, the chief of the Army Mental Health Advisory Team, which conducted the survey, and he joins us from his office in San Antonio, Texas. Very good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Pleasure to be here.
What prompted the Army to conduct this survey?
The Army is always concerned about the well-being of their soldiers, and we at MedCom headquarters in San Antonio, as well as the Office of the Surgeon General in Washington, D.C., we're monitoring indicators coming out of theater, as well as listening to our behavioral health practitioners in theater, and we're considering an advisory team to offer assistance. And then when we saw the increase in suicides in early July, that kind of solidified the decision-making, and the offer was made to the theater commanders accepted, and we put together the team and went over there in August and spent the last part of August, September, and early October in theater.
And what indicators particularly worried you?
We were looking at the number of soldiers who were seeking mental health care in theater, the number of psychiatric evacuations out of theater, the reports from our practitioners about availability of resource, ease of movement around the theater. Were they being able to get access to soldiers, and et cetera,
yeah.
That type of data.
And we mentioned the suicide statistics, which are significant?
Well, every soldier is significant in the Army, and if we lose one, that's one too many. And so we want to have an aggressive program to where we minimize as much as possible the risks to soldiers. And when we saw the increase in early July, that was of concern to us and was concern to the command. They undertook the efforts within the theater, everything that they could do, and they asked us to come over and see if there's anything that they had overlooked in, since they were still fighting a war.
Mm-hmm.
And we took with us the suicide prevention program manager of the Army. He joined our team when we took a look at that, and so he went over with us as well, and he was part of the team.
Just one factual question, and that there are, I gather, at least half a dozen soldiers who've returned from Iraq and then committed suicide after they came home. Those are not among the 24?
No, they're not. And we made an arbitrary decision. We debated it quite extensively, and since we were attempting to assess what happened in the theater and the control and the influence of the command upon a soldier once they leave the theater is lost, we chose, for our purposes of our analysis, to include those soldiers who had taken their life on the soil of either Kuwait or Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of soldiers who, subsequent to redeploying from the theater, took their life, and there were, right at present, that we know of seven that have done that.
So what, as you looked at this, how available were mental health experts and facilities to soldiers in Iraq? Obviously, on a battlefield, this is going to be chaotic.
The battlefield is very chaotic, and Iraq's a fairly large country, and our soldiers were dispersed quite widely throughout the whole theater.
Mm-hmm.
We found in the theater that we had one behavioral health practitioner for approximately roughly 850 to 900 soldiers throughout the theater. And we felt that was a very good ratio. We really don't have a golden yardstick to base it upon, but based upon our team and our experience, we thought that that was a good ratio. There were pockets where that was less than that, and when we found that and spoke with the command, we would work to move additional assets to be closer to the soldiers. Early in the conflict, when they first arrived, they had units dispersed all through the theater, and that meant that our even having that ratio, our behavioral health professionals would have to convoy to get out to the various base camps. And that presented a problem because in an active war zone, any time that a convoy is on the road, you have to have a tactical convoy, which means you have to have multiple vehicles, they have to be armed, you have to have security, a crew-served weapon, and in order to get that team out, it would require the dedication of that entire convoy. So movement in a tactical situation is always problematic, and we looked at ways that we could address that. And in areas that were more sparsely populated, our troops were more dispersed, we recommended perhaps increasing the ratio, have more practitioners to soldiers.
Now, another problem, as I read some of the results of the survey, were lack of supplies in some cases, antidepressants, sleeping pills.
Yes. We asked the practitioners specifically about the ease of being able to get the medication. And when we go into an active combat theater, the speed with which our troops moved created a logistical problem for us, and sometimes we did not have the right medications or the right stocking levels for the medication early in the conflict. As the theater, what we called, matured, as we were able to get the supply routes established and secured, we saw less and less of that problem, and by the time that we were there, there was far less of that problem than early in the theater. Most of the reports that we got when we surveyed our practitioners occurred early in the deployment, and we were there about 6 months into the deployment.
Right. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's begin with David, who joins us on the phone from St. Paul, Minnesota.
I'm Neil, and Colonel, sir. I'm very happy that they're actually trying to get mental health services into that operational theater in Iraq. Now, I did not serve in Iraq. I'm a 20-year veteran. I served in the United States Air Force for 6 years between 79 and 85. I've been in the Army Reserve, and right now I'm in the National Guard, working avionics. It's interesting because I have to say that my gratification is tempered by the degree to which this is a matter of catch-up. It is well known, it's well known generally in the military that it is not a career enhancement move to seek mental health care while in uniform, whether that is in peacetime or in wartime. And there has been perhaps a certain amount of rethinking or relearning, and that's a good thing. But I have to say that there is still a culture in the military, whether it's in the active or in the reserve component, that if you have a mental health problem, there is a great tendency to basically sit on it and certainly not report it, because number one, depending on your occupation, it's a great way to lose your security clearance.
Yeah.
It's a great way, as a result of that, to lose your military operational specialty, otherwise known as MOS, and it's a great way to basically stick a dagger in the heart of your military career if you hope to have one.
Let's get a response from Colonel Patterson.
We know that there are barriers to soldiers getting mental health care. Most of those are perceived, and many of them are culturally derived. We attempt to mitigate against those barriers and even the stigma of receiving mental health care by having our behavioral health practitioners be very proactive in their outreach program. We're strongly, one of our recommendations, and we're strongly encouraging them to be out in the unit at the company level and the battalion level, to where the chain of command and the soldiers know who their people are, to be readily available, that they have the opportunity to either talk to the chaplain or a behavioral health practitioner. And our combat and operational stress control is not treatment. Its primary focus is upon prevention and can move into treatment. And in that preventive mode, there is no record. So the impact upon the soldier's career is not documented, and we encourage the soldier to talk in a preventive manner, and we know that there's a lot that we can do in an educational and in a preventive mode that can be beneficial to soldiers to help them develop the skills and the coping mechanisms to handle the stressors of...
But what about the culture that David was talking about? I mean, this is a pervasive problem.
It's a pervasive problem in America, and, and we're a reflection of that culture, and the military is a very macho culture. Mm-hmm. And so we recognize it as a problem. Earlier this week, we were speaking at a major conference of combatant commanders, and we addressed the problems in the culture, and the senior leadership, the division commanders and corps commanders, are aware that there is a cultural problem, and they're committed to addressing it. But that changing that culture requires changing attitudes at the senior leadership level and down at every soldier level.
David, thanks very much for the call. It's a good question. Let's go now to Alan, and Alan's with us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Good morning, sir, and thank you for taking my call, Mr. Conant.
Sure.
I belong to I'm an Army reservist here out of Vancouver, Washington. I belong to a forward surgical team, and our mission on the battlefield is to go forward and provide medical care, surgical care, to combat casualties. Fortunately, we were not super busy. We found ourselves with a lot of downtime. I'm a staff sergeant. I'm NCO. Part of my job is to take care of my troops, and I found that our problem with morale was not having a huge need for our mission. So we had a lot of downtime, a lot of time that we had to fill with other things. We found ourselves thinking of home and our families and all those things. We were there early, moved quite a bit throughout the battlefield as we were needed, and didn't really have the opportunity to call home, email home. None of that stuff was set up yet. Took us 30 to 45 days to start getting the mail flow from home to us and from us back to home. So that created a big deal to us, and that was our morale issue, was not having a mission to fulfill and not being able to contact people at home.
Yeah. Colonel Patterson, did you find that?
Yes. Alan, I'd like to thank you for your service to your country.
You bet,
we appreciate your dedication and commitment. We find that the soldiers, our soldiers are connected, and they have connections with their loved ones and the people they care about. And the expectation is that that also carry over into the battlefield. And early in a deployment or early in movement into the theater, that capability doesn't come. And our soldiers, we were there 6 months into it, and we still had a significant number, about better than half, who reported they were still having difficulty communicating back to the home front, either by telephone or by email, and there were some spotty difficulty with the mail service itself. As the theater matures, as we're able to get a better infrastructure, more phone lines, better email capability, the soldiers are able to communicate back to the home. But the connection to their loved ones and to the home is a big morale boost for our soldiers, and we recognize that. And we found that when we did the survey as well. That's reported in our report.
Alan, thanks very much for the call.
Hey, and thank you for taking it. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Colonel Patterson, we thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
Colonel Virgil Patterson is chief of the Army Mental Health Advisory Team, which conducted a recent survey, or last summer's survey, on soldier morale in Iraq. He joined us on the phone from his office in San Antonio, Texas. We're talking about troop morale in Iraq. We'll take more of your calls when we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. If you've served in the military, what do you think affects morale for you and your fellow troops? If you've got family who served in Iraq, tell us if you were able to monitor their morale. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing troop morale in Iraq. Of course, you're invited to join us. If you or a family member served in Iraq, how prepared were you to deal with emotional or morale issues? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, TOTN@npr.org. And joining us now is Dr. Paul Reagan, an associate professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He served as a Navy psychiatrist for 11 years. His service included 5 months in the Middle East during Desert Storm. Very good of you to join us today.
Good to be on board.
We were talking with Colonel Patterson about the Army's thoughts on this survey. I know you've seen it. What do you make of the results, particularly of the suicides?
Well, clearly, the latest figures, and they're revealing, I think it was either, they originally said 24, and now they've revised it to 23 suicides, up from the original 19 in the report, is very significant. And I think that reveals that they clearly have a problem on their hands.
A problem, as you look at the timing as well, most of those suicides, as I understand it, were last year.
I believe so. So we're talking about between April and December of 2003. And given the number of people that were on active duty and the amount of over the amount of time, we can calculate the suicide rate, and it's clearly above, statistically significant, and above what the Army Army's baseline suicide rate is. Mm-hmm. And I think that it suggests that these soldiers are under a tremendous amount of stressors, and there is insufficient support. Anywhere from the command, you spoke earlier in the program about the prejudice towards seeking mental health assistance, maybe not having enough practitioners on board as far as the number of psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers available in terms of proximity of providing care. What was interesting is what prompted the team to go over there was a spike in the number of suicides in July. And I think that was probably when it was starting to hit the troops. This is going to be a prolonged guerrilla action at this point. I think President Bush said that the major fighting in terms of the war ended May 1st.
Right.
And so now at the 2 to 3 month mark, it's starting to set in.
The other points that they made in the survey was that it was before a troop rotation scheme was put into effect, so soldiers and Marines didn't know when they were going home. And it was also the middle of the summer when a lot of people were living in tents under very uncomfortable situations.
It's very hot there. Believe you me, it is extremely hot during the summer, very inhospitable. So I think that individuals have an accumulation of different stressors that we know cause suicide, and I think that the cases can be looked at, but I think also stepping back and saying, from a systems point of view, what does this say, and what does the Army need to do to address it?
And the other question, of course, is suicide an accurate or reasonable measurement, a way to gauge morale?
Well, it's not the best way. You really want to be detecting your morale problems a lot earlier in the course. So suicide is a fairly tragic way of it coming to your attention that morale is poor, because obviously the loss of life is not reversible.
Yeah.
So but clearly we see it as huge sentinel events that are the tip of the iceberg.
Given that, do you think that the planners, and again, they went in with numbers that they gave this some thought, but clearly perhaps not enough?
Well, one of the things that in the report that the Army clearly does admit to and document is that they know a lot about suicide prevention, and in all four branches of the service, they've been talking about suicide prevention for many, many years. I remember being asked by a Marine Corps general to give a suicide prevention talk to his colonels back in 1987 at Camp Lejeune. So they've been aware of this for a long, long time. But in the report, they said that they did not transport the suicide prevention program from in garrison, that is, from the home bases to the field once it became an extended stay in terms of the police, you know, action, fighting a more of a guerrilla tactics. They did not export it to the military
to the battlefield. But why not?
That was a I don't have an answer of that was an oversight on their part, and and clearly I'm not an expert in that, but the other observers have said that the planning and the preparation from the war was outstanding and an overwhelming success, but some people have said that the resources to, quote, do the nation building, end quote, was not as well thought out, and this may have been one of the areas that they did not properly plan and anticipate.
All right, let's get a caller involved. Robert joins us on the line from Mesa, Arizona.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I'm just calling. I'm a disabled vet. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, actually, from an incident in Kuwait in between the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War. And I noticed my chain of command left me high and dry, including my NCOs. I'm very concerned about the soldiers coming back, and I'm sure there's going to be many reports of post-traumatic stress disorder in the ranks. And I'm surprised I haven't been contacted by anybody asking me why this happened to me. And, you know, I don't know how to say this exactly.
Yes.
It seems like a preventable thing, but, you know, I was honestly left to leave the military as a staff sergeant, you know.
And unresolved, apparently.
Unresolved. Yeah. It is unresolved. It's still going on. I was in a small unit. Me and another soldier were deployed from a town that was, it was a small base in New Mexico. We left there. I wanted to go. He did not want to go. He died over there. I was involved with the cleanup. And now, looking back on it, I know there's people over there dealing with their buddy's deaths that, you know, I don't know how the military could fix this. I think it's at the commander's discretion, and I think a lot of commanders have their personal bias towards mental health.
Right. Dr. Reagan, obviously situations like Robert is in, the death of friends, seeing it, having to participate in the not only in the incident, but in his case, the cleanup afterwards, that's got to be one of the main stressors.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that the military has put out, it sounds a little bit gruesome, but there are less killed in action and a lot more wounded in action in this particular war. And I think that proportionally we are going to have much larger number of PTSD cases come out of this.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, absolutely. And the purpose of the in-the-field psychiatric, the combat stress centers that the Army has lots of manuals and knows how to do is to address the combat stress or acute stress reactions and try to prevent PTSD. But I do confess that it seems that after each war, we reinvent the wheel. The basic principles of combat stress were clearly delineated after World War I, and we had a horribly inadequate number of psychiatrists at the beginning of World War II. We reinvented it with Korea. We reinvented it with Vietnam. And I think that the high turnover of the number of personnel in the military is there has to be some way that the corporate memory stays put and ways of addressing. The military is an expert in these areas, but the implementation and then getting, for example, somebody like the caller when they're distressed, getting that person the help they need in a timely fashion can prevent. The problem is that so often the soldier, the sailor, or Marine or Airman has this feeling that they're weak or that they're not strong enough and don't come forward. And clearly, as the Colonel Patterson said, it's the rank and file lower level commanders that need to be constantly re-educated and make sure that when people are distressed, that they're not criminalized, they're not seen as being weak, they're not discouraged from getting the kind of help they need, because getting timely help will actually prevent PTSD later. But clearly in this guerrilla action where the bombs, you can't see the enemy, they're willing to hide behind women and children, that's going to be very conducive developing PTSD. The fact that there's lots of people coming back surviving their injuries, but when you have a 22-year-old who loses both his feet or his leg or something like that, there's going to be a lot of repercussions from that. So I think both the suicide rate and the morale issues reveal from a systems point of view the cost of this kind of war and the cost of this kind of action on a prolonged basis.
Robert, are you getting help from the VA?
Yes, sir, I am. I'm actually 100% disabled. That's also a problem. I'm pretty much encouraged not to work. So I don't mind, you know, sitting around and not doing anything. I'm an artist now, but there's things that I know. You know, I'm not a dumb person. I know that I can help in this, and I'm not being approached by the Army or, you know, the VA is their own thing. They're going to worry about veterans. Why don't they come to us who are suffering this and ask us what can we do to help people out? And what failed you? What failed me? You know, ask me.
Robert, good question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
All right, thanks.
Paul, Dr. Reagan, one of the things you have to ask is, of course, all war by its nature is extremely stressful, but the situation in particular in Iraq, do you see any correlation between mission and morale? In other words, as the mission of American troops becomes increasingly controversial, does that affect morale?
Without question. Without question. And I think we have to be very careful that it's such an obvious thing, but if we don't remember history, we repeat it. And that's exactly what happened in Vietnam. And once the mission becomes ambiguous, once you it turns out when you place humans in a no-win situation, that induces anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And so do a lot of our highly trained young people in Iraq with a great weapon system, are they placed in a no-win situation? Because with you know, low-tech weapons and techniques, they're being stymied. And you can't just suddenly turn around and mow down a whole bunch of people because someone's lobbed a homemade explosive at you and then faded off into the marketplace. If we place them in these very untenable situations, that will induce an enormous amount of psychological distress and stress and strain that can lead to poor morale. And the Army in their report were very, they didn't highlight it, but if you read the detail, the report, they describe very poor morale in the troops. 50 to 70% had low morale. And that's highly, highly concerning.
Where our guest is Dr. Paul Reagan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Of course, the troops themselves are not the only people in this equation. Joining us now is Thomas Ricks, a military correspondent with the Washington Post. A recent story of his focused on a new poll of military spouses, and he joined us from the post offices here in Washington, D.C. Good to talk to you again, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
How did the spouses say they're faring?
It was mixed. They generally said they feel they are well supported by the Army. They feel they're supported by their spouses. They feel that the American public supports them, even if it doesn't really understand them. That said, they still feel a real strain. 50% said they think the Army is heading for a major personnel crisis. Another 25% said they thought the Army was heading for some personnel problems. That indicates some real problems down the road for the United States Army.
And this would be in reenlistment.
Especially in reenlistment, but also in how they talk about to the rest of society about whether you want to be part of this organization, and that will affect the recruitment picture as well.
Did the survey cover how well their kids are doing?
Kids were a real surprise to me in the survey. I hadn't focused on this as a military reporter. I tend to focus on more like things what's happening in Iraq.
Sure.
So it was a real education for me. I spent time in kindergartens and first grade classes. Kids, I came away thinking that military dependents are the unacknowledged soldiers in the war on terrorism and in the war in Iraq, that they are basically draftees. I was in first grade classrooms where every kid knew who Saddam Hussein was, and they all think their dad captured him.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Ringgold Elementary, the closest public school to the front gates of Fort Campbell, which is the home of the 101st Airborne, and one of the teachers was telling me about the day a kid came running into the office and said, "There's a Black Hawk down." And it actually was November when two Black Hawks collided over Mosul and killed 17 soldiers. But this is a population of elementary school kids who know that it's important to them when a Black Hawk helicopter goes down in Iraq and they're paying attention to the news. That really struck me. So I think kids are really carrying a disproportionate load in this war.
As you looked at this survey, we all go back to the experiences of the Vietnam era and the feeling of many military personnel and military families that they were being shunned by the American public and by people afraid to wear their uniforms, not afraid, but disinclined to wear their uniforms out in public. It's not approaching that at all, is it?
Not at all. They don't feel shunned. They hear a lot of support, somewhat clumsy support from the American people without a lot of understanding. This was referred to as the Dixie Cups and the chain link fence syndrome of, we support our troops. But people not really understanding how you support the troops, how you talk to them. Odd problems. One young wife, 18 years old, was a cashier at Walmart. And when her husband called on her cell phone from Iraq, when he got a chance to call, the first time he called, she was chewed out by her manager. She said later on the Walmart managers became much more accommodating about this, but at first they were really not ready to deal with it. So support from the American people, they kind of feel is out there. They worry that they'll lose it. I found military spouses agreed, especially on one thing, they hate the media. They really don't like the media's coverage of the war in Iraq. They don't like the media's coverage of military families, and they worry that the negativity that they see in the media's coverage of Iraq might undercut the public support for the military. So they worry the public might eventually turn on them. They don't feel that now. This is a major difference, though, from Vietnam also is it's a much narrower part of society carrying this burden. Back in the Vietnam War, you had a draft, and so you had millions of people literally serving in the Army and cycling through Vietnam. You don't have that anymore.
Tom Ricks, I understand you're on your way to Iraq.
A couple of days from now, yep.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Tom Ricks is a military correspondent for The Washington Post. His books on the military include Making the Corps, about the Marines, and he joined us from the offices of The Washington Post. We're going to take a couple of more calls on the issue of military morale when we come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're discussing military morale in Iraq. Our guest is Dr. Paul Reagan, an associate professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, who did 11 years as a psychiatrist in the United States Navy. That included 5 months in the Middle East during Desert Storm. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255 or email TOTN@npr.org. And let's hear from some more listeners. And joining us now is Kim, who's on the line from Minneapolis.
Hello.
Hi.
I just got back from Baghdad. I was at a core intelligence facility. I was an analyst there. And a couple of things struck me. One, we were fighting the battle of the mundane. Our hours went into the 14-hour days plus training, 16 and a half typically. And where this was fine for 2 or 3 months, when you went into 4, 6, 8 a year, it really brought down morale in a big way, and the Army thinks it's on an exercise, and it's not. It's there for the long term, but they don't seem to realize that, and we never got a day off. In fact, I just heard from a friend of mine who's still there. He says they're giving people half a day, meaning 6 hours off a week, and it's interesting that I think it works against productivity in the long run that they profess to have those people on for. But it really brings down morale, and it starts to eat at you after a while. You hit a wall.
Did I understand you correctly, Kim, to say that you were getting training in addition to what your regular duties were?
Yes. Usually you would get physical training. It lasts an hour, but then you have to rotate showers because there weren't enough showers to go around.
So, I see.
And then you had training also, which is very interesting given that you're supposed to be in a hazardous environment. So it would vacillate back and forth. Again, core facility. Too many generals hanging around. But and then the other experience, you know, for us personally, and this happened throughout the MI community, there was something called cross-leveling. Cross-leveling is when you're at a reserve unit and you get called from your reserve unit to be attached to a reserve unit that needs filling in another jurisdiction, in another section,
mm-hmm.
RSC. So when you get cross-leveled, and we had 40% of the unit was cross-leveled. The cross-levels never had a sense of belonging. They felt like that they were left behind. Sometimes equipment got to them much later and not very good equipment. So you really did not have a sense of belonging that you're used to with a reserve unit that you've trained for.
Cross-leveling being would have been a temporary duty assignment, right?
Theory has it, yes.
Yeah,
but you're
yeah.
cross-leveling for a year.
Yeah. Well, let's
come back with your regular unit.
Hear from Dr. Reagan on this.
I believe her name was Kim, and makes some very good points. What she's describing is classic burnout. People do need time off. That's a serious problem. Number two, she described a poor unit cohesion. The Army has known for centuries. You train together, you deploy together, and you come back together. Unit cohesion is something that really establishes good morale. When you have people, and this was one of the problems in Vietnam, people rotating in and out of a unit breaks down unit cohesion. It sounds like they may not have enough personnel. They're spread very thin, and they're not giving the people time to emotionally refuel.
And that's what was interesting about that is that they continued to say, well, they would spread us thinner, say, hey, we need these people here. But what I saw, what I was able to work out along with my other NCOs, was, hey, we have a schedule. You can give people time off and still. Like I say, if people get burnout, they pace themselves. They're not putting out work like they could if they had a day off, even 10 days or 2 weeks.
Yeah, Kim,
it makes a big difference.
Could I ask what you would have done on a day off in Baghdad?
Oh, boy, slept most of it, done laundry. I personally am an artist in real life, so at least I could sketch or draw. But most people would just, you know, veg out, watch a movie.
Thanks very much for the call, Kim. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Dr. Reagan, it sounds like they've got a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. And the time off, even if you're in a very inhospitable environment, the time off is important because when you're on, you're on. You're on edge. You're vigilant. You're having to work. You can't relax. Time off, when I was in the middle of a general-purpose tent in the middle of the desert, I could read, I could write my letters, I could relax. They're not getting any time to refuel, and that's a big concern. I think there may be some leadership problems because these are all things that the leadership training that they have in the military knows how to address this. This is leadership 101. I'm not sure exactly what the problem is, why that's not being properly implemented.
Dr. Reagan, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Paul Reagan, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, also a former Navy psychiatrist.